Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for being here. I'm going to do the usual sort of disclaimer at the beginning of the meeting. This meeting will be recorded and the sound recording subsequently made available via the Council's website. Please also note that under the Openness of Local Government Bodies Regulations 2014, that other people may film, record, tweet or blog from this meeting. The use of any images or sound recordings is not under the Council's control. So, thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Mince pie for everybody, seeing as it's Christmas. And off we go. Do we have any apologies? We have no apologies. Minutes of the previous meeting. If I can just go through page by page, because I have a couple of points just to query or just to double check. So page 4, anything from that from anybody? Page 5. Page 6. Page 7. Just on the resolved items on page 7, I just noted point 1. We asked committee concerned budgeted for managed savings that are found during the year. Period 7 monitoring report to be considered by the committee at its next meeting provides an explanation of how that is in hand. I'm comfortable that that's there and we can deal with that tonight on that particular point. Page 8. Page 9, again under the resolved items, reference the fleet on point 1. There's a couple of things around this final decision about the funding, and there's an issue from Audit Committee, which basically the request from this really is just that we are informed at the point or the date at which that split is decided on how that's going to be funded. But there is also a residual issue that I have to write about from Audit Committee to Cabinet, reference an issue over the borrowing limits and the linking of additional borrowing limits to the fleet cost, which came out of Audit Committee. So I will do that individually off the back of this meeting, but I just note that that point is there if this committee can be informed when that decision is made. Page 10... Page 11. Everyone happy that when I finish this meeting, I sign the minutes for Laura? Okay, splendid. Next item on the agenda, disclosure of pecuniary and personal interests. Do we have any? Declarations of the party whip. Item 5, questions under scrutiny committee, procedure 11.16. Nope. Into item 6, the first main point on the agenda, performance monitoring, performance indicators, quarter 2, pages 12 to 17. I'm going to ask Mr. Jackson to open the conversation on that one, and then we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Chair. This is, I suppose, good news in a way, in that we have no indicators that are rated as red, so they're all either rated as green or amber. And that being the case, the protocol is that as there are no red indicators, the relevant heads of service and lead members have not been required to attend. There is quite a lot of detail in here and no doubt things that members may be interested in, so if there are any queries I will do my best to answer them along with Councillor Barclay and Leslie Tansey, but a lot of the answers do derive from individual heads of services, so it may be the case that where we can't answer them, we'll get Laura to note them in the minutes and to give you an answer subsequently. But the idea is that there aren't anything that's identified as being red and therefore of a material level of concern. But obviously, if we've got some detailed questions, happy to go through those and we'll answer them as best we can.
Thank you very much. I will turn page by page, and if you have individual items to those performance indicators, if we can reference them. So page 19, SLE1, any observations or comments, questions? Yes, Councillor Shepherd.
Thank you. Could I just check that I understand properly what NS stands for?
Where are we? Excuse me. Where are we referring to?
For your red NS.
Oh, NS. Not started. Yep. So, go back, any on page 19, SLE1. Over the page, page 20, ERM1. I did make the observation, just a small point, that we haven't increased flood wardens or trained emergency centre volunteers since the quarter one figures, and just this seems like the right time to do it in the winter when everything's flooding. I don't know whether that's an appropriate. I presume there is a campaign running during this period. It seems more pertinent and relevant that we're doing that now, not in the middle of summer. The ERM5. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just wanted to say, can try and remember to use the microphones for the purpose of the sound recording, please. Thank you.
ERM5. My observation is just well done. 99% of customers surveyed. That's an increase on quarter one, and obviously anything that's 99% is pretty good, really. So well done on that. Page 21, ERM5, CIS2, or CLS2, I don't know if it's CIS or CLS.
Customer Information CIS, yes.
Any on the first one? I just made an observation about the final section of that paragraph, where it says A, B in bold. Where it says following approval, the supplier GovMetric will then be contacted and the first stage of implementation will begin. When we have statements like that, is it possible to sort of get the question when answered before it appears on the report so that it comes with it says quarter four or it says next year or it says by June or whatever, so that there's a couple of other points in this report or in tonight's papers where I'm going to ask the same thing where another document or another action is referenced but we don't have a date that this committee can follow up on or log as to when it's going to happen, that we can come back and check on it. ERM5, S1? No. ERM5, SS2? Is it possible when the resident survey is available, it says it's completed, results are due by 14th October, will it be distributed?
The resident survey will get published in due course, so I haven't seen the final copy. I think it's been completed, but there is some just refining and checking of the data and validation of the data, but as soon as it's available, I don't see any reason why this committee couldn't see it. So. Okay. If we want to make a note of that in the minutes, and we'll see if we can get that to you as soon as we can.
Yes, Councillor Shepherd.
Thank you. Was there any indication of what those who didn't rate it as good were finding difficult or in service?
Sorry, apologies, Councillor Shepherd, I didn't quite hear that question.
You need to dip the microphone, Councillor Shepherd.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. Looking at ERM3 SS1, The customer survey, 52% rated the web-rated service they received was good. Okay, that's good news. But have we got any detail of what the others thought was not good?
Sometimes we have. So we do invite comments on the web pages. Some of them actually are connected with the fact they can't find something on the web, so that obviously elicits a negative comment. And we did actually change the look and feel of the website relatively recently. I can't quite remember then. So people who were previous users may have found some bits unfamiliar. In other areas, it's actually the users have been unhappy with other aspects of the survey. So their unhappiness or dissatisfaction stems from they don't necessarily like the answers or experience of other aspects of our service rather than the rather than the web. And actually what we find is the web net satisfaction, and this is apparent in the national GovMetric figures. Web net satisfaction is always much lower than the face-to-face and telephony, where customers are actually able to engage with the person and explain and have a more of a dialogue. So the relatively low levels of satisfaction for web is a standard feature, but it doesn't. The fact that it is negative doesn't necessarily always relate to the website, but we are reliant on customers leaving feedback to actually get an understanding of what that is about. Some of them do, some of them don't.
Over the page, on page 22... very hard to read with my eyesight against the yellow background. DES1SS1, I think that is.
That's correct.
Any comments? DES1SS2. If committee will forgive me, I'm going to have a very small rant at this point. One slightly personal and one with regard to the committee, to seek committee's view. I believe the draft corporate plan and draft business plan should be available around now, and I think either one or both will go to Cabinet in January. We have held back from reorganising our work plan in lieu of receiving the corporate plan in draft form and the business plan in draft form, because it is my view that myself and Councillor Baines as Vice Chair should come to you with a strategic scrutiny plan, not a month by month, a couple of key decisions in advance, looking at the routine cycle. We shouldn't operate in that way. However, I can't do that without site visibility of the corporate plan, the business plan, and personally, and I'm going to ask your permission to request it on behalf of the committee, but I want the Cabinet forward plan, the Cabinet forward agenda that they work to, because I don't believe a scrutiny chair, we should have that document restricted from us, because I believe we need that to strategically match our work against the forward plan of Cabinet. And we need to see it in all its glory, not a month in advance or when it comes out to us. So I'm going to make that request to the leader and chief exec. I'm either going to do it personally or I'm going to do it on behalf of this committee. It's your choice with regard to the corporate plan, the business plan, which will eventually become available to us in January. But once we see them, we've then got to work very hard before our next meeting to rework our forward work plan to strategically reflect those two documents. But really, the document I want to work to is the Cabinet... I don't know what the name of it is. The Cabinet Forward Programme is the correct name for it. I have had it once many moons ago. But I'd like that to work too, because I think we can strategically plan much better our workload rather than just routinely cycling through the performance indicators, which seems to me not to be the role of this committee.
Mm. Agreed.
In the meantime, Chair, it might help the key decision notice that's published every month. That does generally go 12 months ahead, so it won't have everything on. It won't have the non-key decisions that Cabinet are planning to make, but it will have the majority of items there. At the moment,
we are cognizant of it, but would like all the glory and infill to strategically manage a more incisive work plan going forward, which is more relevant to the role of the council. So I'm asking permission to do that. I'm asking permission to write to request.
I don't think that's an unreasonable request.
I'm happy to accept a nod if there's anyone in disagreement with that.
Which way Laura would nod and a wink or a proper one?
I've noted that you'd like to ask for access to that full forward programme as a committee. I can put that as a resolution if the committee will
have. I will draft the note as well. I'll do it formally. I'll to you, copy you in, but also send it to the leader and chief exec post this meeting.
Okay, thank you. Okay,
thank you. DES 2, bad eyesight, CIS 1.
Can I come back?
Can't read on the yellow background.
Sorry, I just wanted to know what CLT session stood for on the previous one. Is it a training session? What is it?
It's a It is, the CLT stands for Corporate Leadership Team, so it's okay. Where all the directors and heads of service okay. get together, which we do on a monthly basis, and clearly it's an opportunity to run through and right. discuss just things such as this. So
that's fine.
So I think we'll have...
next page, page 23, DES2 CIS2. Any comments, observations?
So I just wanted to check. It says, Joe, once they are online, once we've got a service online, I'm thinking particularly of housing application forms, is that all checked through the satisfaction survey, or is that the website itself? And then if not, how are we checking customers and are happy with the way it's been moved online?
Okay, so I haven't been through that specific form, but anywhere on the website it will ask you, and I think it does ask quite frequently throughout the website when customers are using it, are they satisfied with the pages they found? So hopefully they are satisfied with it, that will be plan A, but if they're not and they're not satisfied with it, hopefully they'll leave us a feedback as to what they're not liking, whether it's the style of the form or they can't follow it, or maybe the connectivity or is not good. I would certainly anticipate that they are able to give us feedback on those forms if they use them via the website.
Okay. Councillor Shepherd.
Following on that point, and really also my earlier point, what I can pick up, it's quite important to distinguish, if we can, between people saying they don't like the channel of communication as opposed to saying they don't like what they're being told on it. I mean, I suppose it's a fairly obvious thing to say, but are we at the moment able to distinguish between those two reactions to don't like this website?
If they give us some feedback, we can usually construe what their issue is. If they don't, if they just put simply they don't like something, then we know that there's some level of dissatisfaction, but obviously it's very difficult for us to tease out why. If they do give us a feedback, usually from that feedback, it is apparent whether it is something about the website itself or the way the website's working or possibly this decision and the information available.
Can I come back on that, Joe? Is there any merit then in looking at whether we can adapt the website to ask people to differentiate between those two reactions? Are you satisfied with the way this website's working and or with the information or the policy or whatever it is that you're reading?
Possibly. It's a difficult one. So we are... So actually, getting customer satisfaction or understanding customer satisfaction from the website is difficult, and it is something we are wrestling with. And I think actually in one of the previous indicators, we do talk about trying to get different feedback. I'm sure I've just read that now. But we are looking to get a different, looking to see if there are any alternatives to GovMetrics and how we might use those. So there are things like Socketim, who again have just changed the way they seem to measure whether a website's any good or not. So we are trying to get an understanding, a feel for our website, get a rating, understand how good it is. There are various ways of doing that. The best thing is, the easiest thing or the most useful thing for us is actually specific feedback from customers who have had a poor experience, and that's really, really useful. But obviously, it does rely on the customers having the sort of time and inclination to do that for us. So trying to design the website and look at how we collect feedback to enable that to improve is something we are looking at.
Councillor Powell.
Again, through the chair. Simon, is it a case of people are struggling to navigate the site? Or could we actually have a caveat in there that says, obviously we welcome your feedback. Based on the feedback, we'll obviously then make appropriate changes. Whereas it's like a one-way conversation in terms of we don't like the website, but not giving much back in terms of why they don't like it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we do try and elicit feedback. I think I think there is an opportunity for customers to give feedback. Partly, you know, there's also other metrics we can use, such as the number of times people start a form. So we know when people start a form and then don't complete it. So that gives us an insight into the fact that either the form was too long or too difficult or too complicated. And there are things I certainly keep going on about internally about. There's one of our internal forms that I absolutely hate, which sort of asks you about five questions, which you answer, and then it says, using the form you've had prepared earlier, please attach that. And if you haven't prepared it earlier, then that's extremely irritating. So there's all that sort of thing, which we've done quite a lot of work to try and eliminate. I mean, we have done a lot of work on the website in the last two or three years, but again, it does rely on customers. It does rely on that specific feedback. But we obviously try and use anything else we can get our hands on. But hopefully, again, the website does allow customers to give feedback if they're willing and able to do so.
Mr. Baines,
just a thought on this, because the latest thinking is around chatbots, really, and the use of chatbots. And I think part of the reason why the rating is so low on the web is because people like to think that their advice is being catered for them rather than a stock response. But do we have any plans to roll out a chatbot service or something similar?
We are looking to trial web chat, which obviously isn't quite the same thing. So web chat is a human being at the other end of it, sort of who responds. So we are looking to trial web chat. So it's all that is predicated on the implementation of the new phone system, which we have had, which has not proven so easy. But I believe that those issues are now resolved. So we'll be looking to trial web chat. Chatbots, I guess, is the next level up from that, or the next phase up from that. We haven't got any specific plans to trial chatbots that I'm aware of, but again, there's no reason why we shouldn't going forward. So, and again, the CRM system, the sort of Lagan or Verint system that underpins what we use at the moment, much of our system, that is actually, we are actually due to review that and consider whether to upgrade or replace that. So again, the sort of technology and the functionality that will considerations will all be part of that process, which will happen over the next two or three years or so, because these are large and expensive things. But yeah, no reason why we shouldn't look at chatbot. If Laura wants to make a minute note, I'll ask to see what thoughts the team have on that, and maybe just record that for the committee.
I think, if I may respond, I think it's definitely worth looking at, because I mean, web chat's brilliant, but it depends on certainly works for Argos very well, but it's only as good as the team you've got sat behind it. Whereas chatbots, of course, are all automatically there, responding, hopefully, if they've been programmed in the right kind of way, to people's responses. I don't think the research shows that not quite as good as a human, but they're not a million miles away. So I think it would really be worth us looking at it. But anyway, you said you want to, so that's great.
Either of the two items on page 23... Page 24. I would just make a comment on the first item, point A. The quarter one performance was a slight delay to quarter two, quarter three on point A. This is now a continued delay to quarter four. What's the problem in terms of, is it something we need to worry about? Is this going to go over into the next year? Sorry, we're on page 24, the first of the performance criteria.
I think that's 13 of 16.
A. Yeah. In quarter one, we were told it was quarter two, quarter three, and a slight delay. We're now being told a continued delay, and now quarter four.
Thank you for the prompt, Councillor Radford. There has been some issues with this. So basically, we've been told that we had a solution to PCI. So personal credit industry compliant. I think that's what PCI stands for. So we had some, we were told we had a solution, but when we actually looked into that solution, it wasn't a solution. So the idea, so the whole basis of this is that we're able to take payments via the phone in a secure environment, so customers can be assured that their details aren't being captured and recorded by potentially rogue members of staff. So it is a standard, and it has been rather complicated because of the way the proposed solutions work with our firewall, which basically the solution was on the wrong side of that. So it's various issues, but we've now gone back to one of the original suppliers, and we have now got what we are convinced is an actual solution to this. So we are now in a position to implement a solution, but the toing and froing and identifying a solution did actually delay us. So that is unfortunately the case.
Any more on page 24? Page 25? Okay, and again, I will do the same on page by page on the business plan indicators. I'm not going to go through them individually.
We've been on about the online information. I found that when the council were trying to let people be informed about where you could look at this new plan to comment and where they were going to have the exhibitions, it was very hard to find. You had to go through about four different links before you found that it was at a certain time in Shepshed, a certain time in Loughborough and what have you. And I do think sometimes the public said to me, well, they don't really want us to go along to these exhibitions to comment. And I think when we release, don't we, that's just come out to say where some of the plans are, we could have done that. Because I don't think sometimes the information that we need to let the public know that we've got exhibitions coming on to look at, like, the plans, is very well informed for the people. And I must admit, in Shepshed, if I had to put it in my newsletter, people wouldn't have known about it. And I did bring it up with the planning department, and I didn't really have a favourable reply. So I do think sometimes if we're having exhibitions and things for people to comment, and what was there as well, there was the people, if they couldn't do it online, for commenting on, and there was nowhere on there to tell you where you sent the forms back to. So I do think it was very badly organised.
Yes, I just apologies. I don't really know a lot about the local plan consultation process, but I'm sure Laura will capture that feedback for us.
On the business plan indicators, page by page, page 26. Any comments, observations, questions? Key corporate indicators, page 27. Yes, Councillor Shepherd.
Really, just to say, I think this confirms Simon's earlier remarks. If we look at the 590 out of 65 respondees rated the face-to-face service they received as good, I think, doesn't that bear out Mr. Jackson's remarks about the face-to-face being preferable?
I hesitate to use the word preferable, but again, if you look at it is the satisfaction scores on face to face are a lot higher. I mean, whether as an individual customer you would find it preferable, is you know, you might prefer to do something online from your home, but when people do come in, I think, to be honest, we have got a very strong team, and actually in the GovMetric league tables, we're often very near the top of that particular league table for both face-to-face and contact centre. But when you look at the scores overall, that's always the case: face-to-face, contact centre, and the web scores for everyone across the board are always significantly lower than those two other categories.
Page 28.
So I accept the point about not preferable, but simply better experience. Yes, understood.
Thank you.
How does that balance out with transformation and what we're going to do with transformation in terms of reducing people's face-to-face contact and promoting online contact, because you're going to have a struggle there?
The vision on transformation and customer experience is we will have one process. So there'll be the idea is that for every transaction there'll be one digital process, and that digital process in an ideal world will enable people to transact with us online, and the back office work that officers do will be minimal, and that's the vision. That requires quite a lot of, certainly a certain amount of investment in technology and business process re-engineering as you go through the integration process. So that is the vision, and the idea is we make the online process so attractive that people would prefer to do something online, and people are and that makes it smartphone friendly, and we have the figures that actually most people who engage with us online do use a smartphone or a tablet, so we know that. But we do also know that that some people will never be online or will want to engage with us in a different way. So what the idea is, we'll take that process and mediate it using either face-to-face or telephony or web chat or even chatbot, and so people will be able to engage with us, and that mediation will ultimately end up in their information being processed in the same way, but that they will have a potentially a face-to-face person or a contact centre person to help them enter that data into our process. So at the moment we're certainly not thinking about closing any angles down. I think we'll never be able to do that. We're not Ryanair, which actually starts from the premise if you're not online, we're not interested in taking your booking. But we will obviously over time hope that we'll have a more of a transition to online service. And actually, when we're fully confident, at the moment we're confident with some of them. But as we become confident with the quality of what we're doing online, specifically and generally, we'll have periodic efforts to promote that and encourage customers to go down that route.
And I think the transformation agenda is front and centre in this committee's eye line going forward. And I think it's very much up to us to make sure cabinet stroke officers get the balance right, and we continue to challenge that on behalf of residents. If there's nothing else on the performance criteria, I am going to move swiftly on to item 7, revenue monitoring, general fund and HRA period 7. That's end of October to you and me. And to run through that item, I don't know whether Mr. Jackson or Councillor Barclay are going to lead on that one with the opening comments.
Yeah, I'm quite happy to do that. The report is fairly self-explanatory. You can see that at the year end, probably the disappointing thing is the non-specified savings target of 300,000. But nevertheless, we've actually identified, as you can see in the report, 72,500. But overall, while not totally satisfactory, the budget, which includes that 300,000 non-specified savings, is in line to come in as per the budget. Now, that doesn't... and also, next year, this 300 non-specified saving was included as a one-off savings. Next year in the budget, it is included in the base budget, so it is a ongoing saving going forward, and so the actual net expenditure for next year is 300,000 less. I'm quite happy to answer questions, but I think that's probably the most relevant thing and thing that will bring the most attention.
Okay, thank you very much. I think there will be a number of questions. I certainly have some detailed questions as well as some slightly more strategic questions, but I'm very happy just to let other members have some observations first.
Thank you. Could I just ask Councillor Barclay, it was a very clear explanation, thank you very much. How much urgency does the Council feel about addressing the unspecified savings? How much pressure are we putting on ourselves, or should we put on ourselves, to find those savings?
I think, bearing in mind that we've got to find savings of $2.7 million over the next 3 years, we're putting an amazing amount of pressure on ourselves to do that, either by increasing income or reducing expenditure. But at the moment, we're looking at increasing income. I think the budgets are coming in more in line with where we're going to, on target, where they should be. In previous years, we haven't been as close to target. But, yeah, that, I think it would be fair to say that there is massive pressure to find the savings, because we cannot... there are many, many uncertainties. We don't know what the funding is going to be after fairer funding review. We know that the reason why we've suddenly had a shortfall is the new homes bonus has been reduced by £3 million. So if you looked at the MTFS and you look at the budget this year, I think it would be fair to say that there's massive pressure to do it.
Okay, if in the absence of anyone else just at the moment, I have a whole series of questions, if I may, to run through. My apologies. So some of them are detailed points, some of them perhaps slightly more. I'm going to talk you through by page number again. So if I go on page 4, this is slightly facetious but does have some purpose to it. If I look at the table on the top of page 4, we are saving £203,900 in managed vacancy salaries, MBS. We are substituting that with £68,300 of, I'll just use the term, agency salary, presumably to get the same work done. So if I'm slightly facetious, I'm saying, well, we've got 203,000 of work done for 68,300 of agency staff. Isn't that a pretty good deal?
I'm not quite sure that is the case, but if it was, I'd be looking to find a lot more of that sort of thing going forward, bearing in mind my previous comment. I'll let Simon have a go at that.
I think it's a very fair question. I think we haven't got the analysis of this, but I think the reality of it is the managed vacancy savings were to reflect actually what we spend on staff in a standard year. So we know, so the budget historically, if you go back 2 or 3 years ago and previously, we budgeted for staff based on 100% of the establishment being in post for the whole year. Now, clearly, there's 550 staff and people resign and then we re-recruit and there's often an interregnum between one person leaving and another person starting, etc., etc. So that's actually... So even if you would call... Even in a sort of normal year, fully staffed, we would never actually spend the 100% of the staff 100% of the time in salary costs. So what I'm trying to say in a roundabout way is that about 98% of the staff costs does actually represent a full staff complement. Does that make any sense at all to members? But basically, we're always going to be running slightly shy of our standard establishment. So I think what these figures reflect are actually a difference between the standard establishment and there's bits and pieces that vary from that. So in individual teams, so in the contact centre, for example, we would always expect some managed vacancy savings because there's it's quite a large team and there's quite a bit of turnover, so there's always going to be those bits and pieces arising. I think what we've got here are areas where maybe we've had a vacancy in a specific post for an extended period of time, or potentially that we've failed to recruit, so in certain areas we do struggle. So I think these individual balancing costs do reflect specific vacancies or specific issue in specific services, whereas in general the 203,000 reflects the fact that it reflects a general churn of staff, and our original estimate about how that churn would translate into a salary saving, or the difference between the full establishment budget and what actually transpires in a normal course of business.
I'm not quite sure I'm any the wiser, but I'll do my best. It's an interesting question. It's an interesting challenge. Page 5, third column, fifth box down, the third line, and that whole paragraph, I don't understand how that can be an ongoing budget saving in 2021-22. That looks like a one-off saving to me. But I don't understand how it's a recurring saving in 21-22. And that's my ignorance, or it's a misprint. I don't understand how it's an ongoing saving. Page 5, third column, I'm counting individual boxes, 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth box down, starting an underspend of 34K for empty homes, legal fees, and additional licence fee income. An earmarked reserve will be set up in 19 for the 50K underspend. This has been identified as an ongoing budget saving. I don't understand how that's recurring saving.
Leslie Tunsey, if I can just explain that point. It was been identified as part of the budget process that the 50,000 can be taken out of the base budget and put into an earmarked reserve. Once that earmark reserve is actually used up, there will be another call to replace that 50,000. So it just depends how long we don't use that 50,000. But you're right, it is a one-off saving to go into an earmark reserve. It was just a way of getting it out of the base budget as it is. So we've not got this situation on an ongoing basis, but we are just retaining that. Because the head of service actually does need that budget in the event of it needing legal fees.
In effect, it is a one-off cost. It's yes. A one-off spend. Okay, so we're not going to see it again.
It's a one-off spend that'll basically go into our earmark as an earmark reserve. It's not actually been used yet, but it's been identified that it's sitting in the base budget year on year and not being used year on year. So we thought it was a sensible approach just to create this earmark reserve as and when it's needed.
Okay. Over the page, page 6. I'm sorry to be making you count. Third column again. All my observations are third column where all the words are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Sixth box down, starting garden waste bin income shortfall. I am presuming what that's telling me is we are planning for a Serco underperformance.
Leslie Tansy, the garden waste bin income is going to be a shortfall of 65k at the end of the year. This is offset by 20,000 underspend on Serco and some KPI income that's due in.
Which is an underspend.
The point I'm making is we're planning on them to underperform, which I guess
yes.
There is a possibility they may not.
Yes, that is an underperformance indicator that we get the money back.
Okay, but we wouldn't get it back if they performed. So it's at risk.
It is a risk, but at the moment, the fact that it's actually gone into this report at this stage of the year, I think And given the fact that previous years it's come in at these figures, it's a difficult figure. We don't necessarily budget for it in the base because it's not guaranteed. So we actually, part of monitoring, we bring it in at this point.
Okay. Councillor Shepherd.
Does that imply that as a council, through the appropriate officers, we should be putting more pressure on Serco to perform to the higher standard? It's not really, I know, a finance question. I'm perhaps airing a thought. If this, but do I make myself clear? I mean,
yeah. Maybe. I think the head. Thanks, Councillor Shepherd. I think the head of service would give a definitive answer. But I think historically, if I'm correct, this KPI actually relates to our recycling target. And I think we've always set a recycling target of 50%, which I think was derived originally from a national standard. I don't think we've ever achieved the 50%, which is why we can be reasonably confident that the 50% won't be achieved this time, and hence the underspend. There is a question about whether the 50% is achievable, actually. I think we do monitor Serco, but I think it's almost accepted that the 50% is the standard, and that's a sort of standard aspiration. And I assume that within Serco's business model, they accept its aspiration and are unlikely to receive that money. So I think it is generally accepted. And, you know, there's obviously a whole topic of around recycling and what we should or should not be trying to achieve. But
Councillor Radford.
When I looked at it, I just assumed it was because there wasn't so many people taking up the garden bin waste since the price went up. So therefore, if there was not so many people having the garden bin, therefore Serco can't collect so much garden waste. That's how I read it. Not that they were underperforming. If we haven't put the stuff in the garden bin, they can't pick it up. But that's just how I read it.
Yes, sorry, Councillor Radford. I think maybe the explanation could be it could be clearer, but it actually relates to three separate elements. So there's garden waste income, which we know a certain amount, and we're projecting an underspend at the year end, and actually also within the forthcoming budget based on the direct debit and the direct debit renewals. So we have a fairly reasonable view of where we are on garden waste income. But in other areas within that service is a £20,000 underspend on sort of general bits and pieces. And then also within that service and within the environmental services contract, there are targets about recycling generally, which would no doubt cover garden waste, but obviously also covers sort of paper and tins and plastics. And that's the sort of general recycling target I was referring to, which we've historically struggled with.
Can I confirm that there's a historical precedent for this, that there's an underspend every year or not?
I hesitate to say confirm, but certainly my understanding is that this recycling target is one that we've always struggled to achieve. I think we've always got to sort of 48.7 or 49.1, but we've never actually achieved 50%. I think maybe councillors with longer memories may help, but if they've been through performance on the sort of recycling target, I think it's usually one that we have historically missed. And again, there is a question about whether it is achievable, and there are challenges actually around the supermarket changing their packaging and actually reducing the amount of packaging they produce, and paradoxically that's making it more difficult for us to hit our recycling targets because there's less for us to go on. But again, it's a complex area. I think it's probably one where I'd feel more comfortable if the relevant head of service answered it, because he's got lots of good answer and knows lots of detail on this topic.
Page 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th box down, the loss of housing benefit admin subsidy grant funding. I'm not an expert in housing and don't sit on that committee. When did we know about that?
Is this the 515?
No, the 42. No. overspend, leading to a 72,000 overspend by year end, the loss of housing benefit admin subsidy grant funding. Is that a government grant? Is that something we were informed about? But presumably we must have been informed about it after the budget was set.
Yes, it's something, the housing benefit subsidy is, it is a little bit of a black art, and it's a very complicated area. So the government doesn't necessarily announce what grants it's giving us until quite late in the day, and sometimes actually we get little bits and pieces of money in the March of the year. So we might get a few bits and pieces of supplementary grants in March, which is basically the Ministry, the Communities and Local Government, finding those extra bits of money which they'd promised us and finally feeling it's they're in a position to release it. But it is quite complicated. It is all connected with a lot of it is connected with the rollout of universal credit, and that's unfortunately the government calculations are that because of universal credit and the rollout, we will require less processing time and our workload is lower. Unfortunately, although people do go on to work universal credit, our workload isn't necessarily decreasing at the same rate for sort of technical reasons, a lot of which are to do with the localisation of council tax support. So essentially we need to do the same amount of checking for localisation of council tax support as you do for housing benefit. And when housing benefit and council tax support were both within our gift, it was fine, but the fact that we lose the housing benefit side of it doesn't actually reduce the workload, so that's part of the issue. But it is generally a complicated area and an area also where the government doesn't necessarily tell us well in advance of what their changes to the grants are.
Next one down, two down from that. I can't help but note the scale of the Carpenter's Arms overspend. Not an area I am averse with. I would appreciate a very brief summary of that situation. I don't know if other members are conversant with that.
They're closing the costs.
Okay, so this is complicated. What this is to do with supported living. So the rules are, I'll try and make this quick as I can, but we offer housing benefit and can reclaim housing benefit back from the government up to an amount of the local rent allowance, up to a standard amount. For individuals who are in supported living, we can, and who are not, and this is a particular point, who are not being cared for or provided for by a registered social landlord. So we've got a particular problem in Charnwood, and it's similar in Chesterfield, but it's not necessarily shared by other districts. We can only claim of the additional costs of living, which are higher in these supported living environments, we can only claim a maximum of 60% of those additional costs if those individuals within the supporting living area are deemed to be vulnerable. So there's two or three issues we have. So one is actually with people moving on to universal credit, the previous housing benefit flags of them being vulnerable have been removed. So therefore, a lot of those individuals who are de facto and obviously vulnerable and not able to work, we're not actually able to claim any of the supplementary costs for them. So we are suffering under universal credit. And the other issue is that the Carpenter's Arms purchased probably two or three years ago what used to be the old Six Hills Hotel on the Fossway, if you know that. If you're old like me, there was a really dubious nightclub there, but I won't go through who went there. But that has about 40 bedrooms from memory, so that level of units in our borough is just unfortunately means that we are having to suffer this additional cost, which is very, very significant. So the combination of the Carpenter's Arms opening that facility, plus the fact the DWP are changing the vulnerability criteria, is a big part of why that number is so high. And that the Carpenter's Arms actually accounts for about half of it. Also, the Falcon Centre is also a big local provider. It's a charity, and that is another big lump of it. And again, they're not a registered social landlord. So going forward, and we haven't got an answer for this, but certainly the system is, we don't believe the system was designed to penalise local authorities like this, and so it will be a question of once the election's over, lobbying our relevant local MPs, talking to the DUP, seeing if there's some other definition of vulnerability we can use rather than the old housing benefit flags, or maybe encourage the Falcon Centre or even the Carpenter's Arms to become registered social landlords, which is not necessarily an easy process, but given that it's costing us £500,000 a year, then it clearly it's well worth us pursuing whatever options we can to try and mitigate this very large amount.
It's a very substantive amount on our budget, 600,000 overspend currently predicted, and is a huge issue when we were looking for 300,000 of underspend to meet our budget this year. This blows it away completely as a 600,000 overspend. So, in fact, we've got to find £1 million where we only had 300,000 to find. So it's a very, very substantive issue.
I think it is, and it's one that's going to my notice fairly rapidly because it's actually developed very, very quickly, hasn't it? Over sort of the last 4 or 5 months, you've suddenly seen a massive increase. And I think what Simon Jackson has said is true. It's to do with the vulnerability markers being taken off and the fact that we cannot claim the money back. But I think it's a significant issue and one that is worthy of very great investigation.
So from a budget scrutiny position next year, given that there is a budget scrutiny meeting tomorrow, this will appear in some part of the conversation because this is obviously over and above where we were the last time we scrutinised the budget. Okay, thank you. Turning over the page, last couple of bits. It's only a tiny amount of money on page 8, but I think we're always, as councillors, concerned when community grants appear to be going out slowly to people. We're somewhat behind what we said we were going to be in terms of the amount we were giving out. I don't know whether it's them not applying, us not getting it processed quick enough. It's always a small concern. It's only small sums involved, but it's always nice if we can get that out at speed to residents on the community grants. I think we'd all welcome that being on budget always and moving quickly. I think that's it on the general fund, and only a couple then on the housing revenue account. Any more on the general fund from anybody? On the HRA, the large figure that smacks on page 9 in terms of the controllable costs, in terms of our budget to 31st October and where we actually are, we're some way behind on the controllable costs, so it makes me feel that it's not actually that controllable, even though it's under our remit. We are some way behind on that. Is there any comment or observation on that?
Yes, I think it's been well documented that we have had various issues with contractors, so the we are obviously it's showing that we're well underspent at the moment. I think there are some specific areas around sort of electrical testing and compliance. So we've spoken to the head of service and they've got some plans to get some, in fact, it was in the procurement plan in the December cabinet report, which talks about electrical work testing and work to try and catch up that. But it is really about the contractor and contractor capacity, which we have actually experienced some issues with. So it is certainly the intention is designed that we would spend that amount of money and do the programme. The head of service is well aware of this and has got matters in place to try and correct this going forward. So we budget for the programme. If we're having contractual problems or contractor issues or capacity issues out in the external market, then that has in recent years shown up, and that's why we have had underspends in this area recently.
Should I read anything into the fact that the end of year forecast isn't in the HRA as it is in the general account? So the HRA account isn't forecasting what it's going to do by year end. I shouldn't read anything into that. So in the general fund, the managers have forecast what they expected the numbers to be by year end, whereas in the HRA we just got it to the end of October.
I think in Appendix 3, the underspend periods, there's an underspend to period 7, and then the head of service is still projecting an underspend to end of the year, but it's lower underspend. So he's projecting a total underspend of 164,000. Okay. If you look at the sort of bottom right of page 10, so at period 7 there's an underspend of 934. Okay. So that's what I'm sort of referring to in terms of getting external help in to sort of catch up with the programme through the year.
Back on page 9. Just an observation similar to ones earlier. I note the reference to the review relating to alternative uses for garage sites. It would be useful if we knew when that's likely to appear, just so that it's dated if we have references to other reviews or other documents being produced that appear on our papers. If we could know when that's going to appear, that would be useful, so that we can close off any questions or bits and pieces from that, if that's possible. Over the page, any questions? Page 10.
From page 9, if I may, go on to page 10. It says, in some instances, on receipt of the benefit, tenants do not pay the full rent to the council. In some instances, sounds like a fairly small proportion. Is it possible to be a little more precise than that in terms of when people get the benefit they don't pay or pay at once? Sounds like a fairly small proportion from the way it's expressed.
I don't know. I think we'd have to get the head of service to provide the detail. I think what we do know, or what I do know, is that housing benefit was designed such that payments went directly to landlords, whereas with universal credit, the idea is people take personal responsibility of their finances, but obviously they have the opportunity not necessarily to pay their rent as the first thing they do, so that's part of why we offer debt advice, maybe to encourage them to do that. But I think if you wanted specific numbers, I think that would be one Laura would maybe have to record and get back to you from with numbers from the head of service on that one.
Page 10. I just observe there are some reasonably sizeable underspends where year end it's predicted it won't be that scale. So in the last 5 months we're going to do 2 or 3 times what we did in the first 7 or whatever, which those observations always concern me. And I struggle to... I would be delighted were we to achieve all those bits and pieces and catch up, but it does worry me. And when I see those sorts of figures, but it's all going to be fine in the next 5 months. I don't know whether that's in general, whether I should be concerned.
I think, in fairness to Leslie and myself, we guessed that this might be a question. So we have. There's a couple of things. So electrical testing is maybe a concern that members might have, but actually there is something if you in the amendments to the annual procurement plan, which comes to Cabinet, which is always not necessarily massively awaited, but in that there is actually a request to get 2 additional contractors brought on board for that last quarter for electrical work. So that will be where. So we'll get 2 more people on board and do that. And on the plan maintenance around external wall installation works, they are going to commence in quarter 4. So to some extent, that's slightly at risk from the weather. So if we have a lot of flooding or snow, it may get a bit more difficult. I guess the foam freezes below a certain temperature, but there is that it is scheduled in that we do a lot of external wall works in quarter 4. So clearly there's a risk, but there is actually also a plan to actually undertake those works and to actually boost the amount of work that we are doing in quarter 4. So again, the head of service would have more detail, but it isn't just purely based on hope. There is a plan to increase our rate of spending in the final quarter.
Any more on 10 or 11? Just a point on page 12, then. I'm struggling to understand the way the bottom table on page 12. I can't quite make sense of it. So I don't understand the whole sort of concept of the table. So it says if I look at the third line down of the non-bold writing, arrears at the end of October 2019, and it's in a column marked 2018-19, and then under the same heading in the next column, it's under a column marked 2019-20. I don't quite understand the layout of the table in terms of what it's trying to tell me in that bottom table. It seems not to make sense to me.
I think quarter four report, it was requested that we had a comparison between 18-19 and 19-20. I think the October 19 in the bottom two boxes needs to be removed, but essentially we're comparing 2018-19 figures in arrears, 1.2 million, compared to the same period, period seven, 2019, and 1.3, just to show there is an increase in the arrears.
Yeah, so it's just a date misprint in those
It does need to be made a bit clearer, but I think it's a good comparison to what was there last time. I think there was only just the one table, so I think it does show that we are slightly increasing on that.
Last question for me on the HRA, then, if there's no more. Oh, sorry.
Through you, Chairman, I thought it was all right because they were comparing like for like. So we've got up to October in both cases rather than... Anyway, I obviously read it wrong. I don't know. I just thought they were doing up to... Anyway, don't matter. I didn't have a problem with it.
My last question is just a simple one on the very last page, page 13. With the larger tenant arrears, where the example is made from 18-19, where we might have gone from 21 to 28 in 19-20, is that 28 new cases, or might that be 21 old cases plus 7 new, or some combination of that? So are they retained cases in those numbers, or is every column new? In other words, it's cumulative. So there were 21 people with over £2,000 of rent arrears in 18-19. In 19-20, we've got 28, but is a lot of that 28 still from the 21 from the previous year, or is this a new 28?
I think we need to get some further clarification on that question from the HRA accountant. I think the numbers have increased, but to answer to the question, is it the same property that's still on the table between the 2 years? I just need to get that clarified.
Because it puts a different light on it about the scale of increase and the scale of the impact. If it's 28 new and all those are new cases, and the old ones have all been closed off, then that's a serious growing issue for us. If it's 7 more or some combination of that, it's 10 more and there's 11 left over from the last, or whatever it might be. Just that split puts a different light on looking at those two columns. So it would be interesting to know that, I think. It would help us understand the scale of the issue year on year. Does that make sense to members?
Certainly check with a HRA accountant.
Yeah, I just don't know. I can't read it from the detail, so I'm not querying whether it's bad or good. I'd like to understand better what it is, if that's possible, if that's presented to us again in that format. Is that okay, members?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I am done. You'll be delighted to know on item 7. Any other questions? Item 8... is our work programme, and I'm tempted not to say very much at all about that because you've heard me express my view that we are just rolling through the same current sort of routine items And we've had the same paragraph in the minutes for the last two meetings, that the chair and vice chair are awaiting the corporate plan and business plan in order to strategically adapt our future work programme to better reflect the Cabinet's work programme and the Council's direction of travel, rather than just be routinely seeing routine performance numbers or routine items. We need to shape our own destiny of scrutiny against the Cabinet work programme. I think that would be strategically sensible. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like we're using our time well if we're just randomly picking things off that don't really reflect the Council corporate agenda. So I'm loath to say too much more other than to say we are likely to roll the work programme as it is, but in the light of we are going to officially send a note to Chief Exec and Leader to request at the highest possible speed draft corporate plan, draft business plan and the Cabinet work programme, such that we can then, myself and Councillor Baines, come back to this committee with a better shaped strategic approach to the next 12 months of scrutiny, rather than just rolling through the current routine items. And there's no point in us picking items off that are not central to the priorities of this council. We can pick our own items, of course, and we have six or seven key areas, but we should be reflecting the work of the council as a whole, but we need to know what that looks like. Otherwise, we can't do that. Are members in agreement with that approach? Okay, Councillor Baines, we're all in agreement with that approach. So unless there are other comments on the work programme, I will draft that note and fire it out through Laura to Leader and Chief Exec to just request that we would like a better visibility of the key documents as early as we possibly can, of which I think key is the Cabinet work programme, because that's quite often the things that there are some quite serious and important items there, which when they hit us with only a month's notice or on a Cabinet agenda, we aren't really in a position to scrutinise well, because we don't have the time and we don't have the foresight to see it coming down the line. And therefore, we cannot be a critical friend. We are just someone in the room picking at what we see in front of us, rather than being able to do our own work and come back in a more strategic sense. Is that okay, members? I don't think there's anything else for me to do at this meeting. So I am happy, if members are, to close this meeting. Yep. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.